My name is Rich Anderson, and the topic of our session today is our addictive personalities. Just a couple assumptions that I wanted to start out with so that we don't get off on the wrong track. One assumption is today I really want to talk about the psychological aspects of being addicted versus the physiological. In other words, we're not really going to get into the whole area of being physically or chemically addicted to something. Like an alcoholic or a heroin addict becomes chemically addicted to the chemical, and then when it's taken away, you can identify withdrawal symptoms and all those sorts of biochemical things going on in the body. Really going to talk about psychological, emotional, relationship types of addiction. The other thing that I want to do is, in general, stay away from chemicals. We'll talk a little bit about chemical addiction. And actually, in studying and understanding chemical addictions, we've found that to be the most fertile research area to discover all the other things that we've learned about psychological and relationship addictions. So if we kind of wander off into talking about drug addicts, or if we wander off into talking about being addicted to other kinds of chemicals, I may pull you back onto this other vein. Okay, let me explain just a little bit. I'm from Cambridge, Minnesota, and I'm a recovering Lutheran minister. And by that I mean I'm also a marriage and family counselor and a chemical dependency counselor, and I'm run a program in a hospital where I have about 19 staff that are doing chemical dependency and codependency treatment and outpatient mental health treatment. And so day in and day out, we're working with people that are chemically dependent and working with codependent people that really are addicted to chemically dependent people. And this presentation today is really kind of part of a two-part series. Tomorrow afternoon I'm going to do something on codependency, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that relationship with the addicted person. And we'll get into that a little bit today. I also realize we're going to be competing with the bowling alley down below. So if you have trouble hearing me, would you just wave and I'll try to speak up. I'm also going to just present a little bit of material to you, go through a few things that I think are real important for us to start thinking about, and then try and give the rest of you time to discuss and raise questions and interact. How many people here, first of all, think they're an addictive personality? Okay, a couple of them. I know I am. I don't believe I'm chemically dependent on alcohol or drugs, but I can name 100 things that I know I'm addicted to. And I think it's those 100 other kinds of things I know I'm addicted to that have gotten me real interested in trying to understand this, and probably have gotten me real interested in working with people that are chemically dependent. And maybe I'll ask the same question at the end of the session, we'll see if the numbers grow. Okay, a few basic information things that I want to start out with are that the World Health Organization's definition of addiction says that it's a pathological relationship with any mood-altering experience, event, or thing that causes major life problems. So, I think there's three pretty major significant areas to think about. First of all, it's addiction is pathological. It's a relationship, and it causes problems. I think if we think about chemicals, if you think about alcohol, we all know that emotionally, again, not psychologically, alcohol doesn't addict people. The relationship that you develop with the alcohol does that. And we know that because there's lots of social drinkers who aren't addicted to it. There's lots of alcohol sitting on bottles in liquor stores that doesn't get you. But it's when you begin to develop a relationship with that chemical that you begin to develop an addictive type relationship. We'll talk a little bit more about relationship. Pathological, I think, is important to understand in the sense that it describes destruction, it describes dis-ease, an interesting way of dissecting the word disease. Pathological talks about pathos, Greek word for death, destruction. Pathological experience in addiction talks about harmful consequences, and I think it's relating to those problems that become significant red flags in our life as a result of our addiction. These are the kinds of things, pathological issues are the red flags that we look for to try and decide if this is an addictive problem. One of the things that we do in assessing chemical dependency is look for pathological consequences, problems exhibited in their life as a result of their chemical use. Social drinkers don't have problems in their life because they drink. Chemically dependent people do. Relationship, I think, is also real important. It's often, and at least in this definition, they say it's with an event, an experience, or a thing. Not necessarily always with some kind of chemical that controls you. I think what happens is that what's important in understanding relationship is that it's a distractor. In other words, in trying to understand addiction, what's real important is to take a look at the fact that if you develop a relationship with something that distracts you, that gives you an out, that gives you a cop-out, that gives you an alternative away from, that gives you an escape, it can become addicting. The interesting part about it is that we talk about mood altering. And at the base of this, of course, is emotions and feelings. That what we do with our emotions and feelings is real important. We all have them. We all live with them. We all deal with them regularly. They're neither good or bad. They just are. And what you do with the feelings or emotions you have, I think, is a significant thing here. A lot of people, when they have difficult, problematic, painful kinds of emotions, rather than maybe sitting down with somebody and talking out the problem, or rather than working out the emotional struggle of some sort, have been taught, like good Europeans or Scandinavians, to do what with them?
Bury them.
Stuff them. Right. And then when you stuff them, what do you need to do to continue to get away from them? Got to find some kind of escape. And the important thing is that if you find a distraction, something to get involved in, away from that feeling or emotion, that becomes real reinforcing, doesn't it? If you can have an argument with your spouse where you get really angry at him or her and walk out of the room and go sit down and watch television and forget it, and not deal with your feeling but get lost in the TV show, what a wonderful distraction from having to continue the argument, from having to resolve the problem, from having to face up to your own feeling or emotion, from having to together share and work through the feelings and emotions to get them resolved. And a lot of people do that. A lot of people, I think, run away from, avoid, distract themselves from their emotions and their feelings. from their anxiety, from their stress, from their relationships. Okay. One of the things I think that's real important is the distraction changes how we feel. Or it changes our ability to feel or be aware of what we feel. So if you're feeling a lot of grief over the death of your mother or your father, if you can run off and get real involved in something else that keeps you real busy and active so that you don't ever have to pay attention to that, it's a good distraction. It changes how you feel. Or changes your ability to be conscious or aware of or in touch with how you feel. And it's really kind of a mini vacation. In chemical treatment, we talked about going out on a Friday night at the end of the week as a, you know, very common 6-hour vacation at the end of the week. It's a chemically induced 6-hour blitz. You don't have to feel, you don't have to think, you can just let it go. And it's a chemically induced distraction. I think to understand addiction fully, we need to look at probably our own lives. A lot of people I know have a difficult time trying to understand, well, how could somebody become an alcoholic? Or how can this alcoholic continue to be that way or continue to do that in the face of seeing how much it's ruining his family and it's ruining his... Hello. Ruining his kids and ruining his life or her life. I think the way to understand that is take a look at things that we do in our lives that are out of control. Are there things in your life that sometimes get out of control? Now, I think about that, and I'm regularly doing things out of control. I guess one of my basic philosophies is, and I know I learned this from my parents, my father taught it to me real well, and that is, I want to write it down here because it's my favorite. Anything worth doing... What's the rest?
We're all addicted.
Wait a minute. Is worth doing to excess. My father's a tinkerer, and he discovered that if his neighbor was going to throw out his lawnmower, he could bring it over, tear it apart, fix it, and he's got a working lawnmower and didn't need to buy one. 6 months later, I find out my father's got 8 lawnmowers. You know, if one repaired lawnmower is good, 2 is better, 3 is better yet. And I do this all over in my life. I've been in love with old cars, and 20 years ago I bought one. Today,
5.
I have 5. Right. And of course, you've got to find them, you know, in wrecks and piles and bring them home and they're wonderful parts and you clean them up and put them together and pretty soon, you know, 2 are nice and 3 are better and more and more and more. I got interested in exercise. Started to run. Well, you know, once you can run 1 mile, okay, what do? You run 2. And then pretty soon you're running 4. And then you're running 10Ks. And then once you're running...
Marathons.
Then you're running marathons. And then what's after marathons?
Triathlon.
Ultramarathons. What?
Beating
shirt. Training. Orthopedic surgery is what he said. And that's what I had. I ran till I got shin splints in my legs. And then I ran on medication and tape. Because, you know, I was only a month away from the marathon, and I've been training for 6 months, and there's no way I'm not going to do this thing. And I ran through the marathon, you know, with tape and anti-inflammatory and pain medications and finished the thing like a total fool. But I was out of control. I was going to do it. I had a goal. Nothing was going to stop me. And then after I had surgery, I couldn't run for 3 months. So I biked. And now I bike as much as I run. I think what's real interesting is that there's another concept we need to talk about, and it's called compulsion. I don't tell too many people this, but I can read minds, and I knew someone here was going to ask me, what's the difference between being a compulsive personality and between being an addictive personality? Anybody know the difference between a compulsive kind of behavior, a compulsive action, compulsive lifestyle, and an addictive lifestyle? Same thing?
Have to do with the problem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why doesn't have the problem?
The pathology. The destruction, the problems. The compulsive people don't have a pathological relationship. They don't have the problems existing. Now, my guess is some of you are thinking, well, I know a lot of compulsive people that have problems and destructive consequences as a result of their behavior. And I guess my response to that is that then they're addicted.
Even if there's not a pathological reason for their compulsion?
Well, the pathology is the consequence of their behavior, not the reason for it. No. I tend to believe most of this is learned behavior, and that the reason is multitudes. Basically, it's being out of control. And then you got to be real careful there, because compulsive people will tell you, well, I just don't want to stop this.
Right.
And it becomes a real nice excuse for being an addict, mm-hmm. but not admitting it, and having a good, acceptable excuse for continuing the behavior, even though there is destructive consequences. So what I would say is that even if you have a compulsive person who doesn't want to stop, don't look at that as the indicator. Look at if there are problems, destructive consequences as a result of that behavior. Those are the indications about whether there's an addiction or not. Now, my wife is a runner also. I think she's a compulsive runner. She runs more than I do, but she never gets hurt. It never creates problems in her life. She gets up earlier. She goes out and does her 4 miles every day and gets home, and there essentially are no consequences to what she does on a 6-day-a-week basis, 52 weeks a year, except that she gets tired out at 8 o'clock at night and tends to doze off in front of the TV. Well, it's not a real problem, except when we're out socially, you know. And for her, her behavior is not necessarily a distraction. She gets up to do it, likes to do it, keeps her physically fit and feeling well. She is not distracting herself from something. She does it day in and day out.
Some people talk about positive addiction. Would you equate that with compulsion then, or do you even believe in it?
I don't believe in it. It's an oxymoron. I don't think you can have something positive that's destructive. I know William Glasser years ago, you know, after he wrote the book Reality Therapy, came out with the book Positive Addiction. And his examples in there were of being a runner and getting off into the runner's high and running for miles and not knowing where you are and being off into the oblivion trance-like state, and call that positive addiction because it was healthy. And I think at least most of the people I deal with and talk about that's really not a good use of the term.
So compulsion would be better to describe that?
I think so. Compulsive behavior. And compulsive isn't we've got to be kind of careful to not moralize about compulsion as being, you know, wrong or negative or destructive either. But simply a compulsive behaviors are just repetitive kind of things that people continue to do and stick with and are really dedicated to and work hard at and that kind of thing.
It's always had a kind of a negative connotation to me until the way you're talking about it now.
Oh, I think that if it wasn't for compulsive personality types, we'd be in lots of trouble. There'd be loose ends everywhere and nothing would be organized and everything would be a mess. And so I think that those kinds of compulsivities that don't become destructive or pathological are... I think those are real important for order and some kind of structure and direction in life. When they become pathological or destructive, then they become addictive, and then we got trouble. And the interesting thing is that compulsive behaviors start to only really, most of the time, become noticeable to us when the problems start coming up. We start experiencing or seeing the problems or the destructive kinds of things that are happening. And then, of course, it's almost, then it really, it's too late. Then we're off into the addictiveness of it all. So compulsive behaviors are real difficult to identify sometimes. Yeah.
You're calling your wife's running compulsive. I would get a person that doesn't, my dad said, I wouldn't mind if I were like that. Yeah. I'm tired in the morning, I stay in bed. So I said, well, if you discipline, what would be the difference?
The difference is that even though she'd rather stay in bed, she drags herself out. And the days that she says, oh, I'm not going to run today, I'm going to stay in bed, she doesn't feel good all day.
How does she run it over here?
Oh, the Minnesota winter running is the best in the world. It's always summer inside your clothes.
It's not icy.
Well, we live in town, and the streets usually get plowed, or you usually leave the snowplow down the road. There are usually only one or two days all year where it's slippery on the road, and then you just go off the side and run through six inches of snow.
Oh. Road snowshoes.
Yeah, I'm not sure what's your answer, because I would think that that would fit a description of discipline, where if you don't want to get up, you do it anyway because you're disciplined. You know it's good for you. And then if you let yourself down by deciding to stay in bed, you feel bad. And that would seem to fit a description of discipline to me.
Yeah. We may just be splitting hairs on terms. I don't know that it's, you know, if it really is that significant. Yeah, it may start out as a discipline because it's what you want to do. And after a while, you've repeated the discipline so often, pretty soon it becomes a habit, and it becomes a compulsive kind of habit. And that you do it even though it's pouring rain and wretched weather and not even the, you know, dogs.
Even though it doesn't make sense to you.
Doesn't make sense to anybody, but she doesn't. And a disciplined person at some point would say, wait a minute, this is ridiculous. But a compulsive person says, oh, no, I'm going to do it. And yet there are no, you know, destructive consequences as a result. So maybe the compulsive person goes beyond what's rational decision-making and still continues, but doesn't go so far as to have destructive consequences as a result. I don't know if that's a little clear.
So are you saying that the difference between her is that she knew that it was physically harmful to her, she wouldn't continue to do it? Like if you were the
Yeah, with her it's real interesting because she's had times when she's stopped running for a week, been away or something, or couldn't. Or I had a baby, and then when she was pregnant, she ran up to her ninth month, and then she bicycled, and then a couple weeks later, she started getting back to it. But what she notices is that her knees, when she starts getting back, start to hurt, and so she cuts her mileage back, and lays off a little bit here and there and just tends to inch it back up so she can get back up there. An addictive person would say, heck with the pain in the knees, I can run through the pain. I've read articles in running magazines that profess running through pain is the best way to heal. Don't let a little cramp bother you. Just, you know, slow down a little bit and keep going because it'll work itself out. But don't let a stress fracture in your leg bother you. Finish the race like my sister-in-law did. And there are examples in, you know, in exercise kinds of experiences all over the place of people who totally destroy themselves to finish or to do it. Let's vote. How many think they are? Sure. Well, sure. The addict community is, you know, heavily entrenched with good writers who profess their theologies.
Athletic addiction or compulsion is a little different than other kinds of compulsion because you actually are addicted to something. Your body makes endorphins as you exercise and you become chemically kind of dependent upon your own body making these drugs. It's a natural hormone, but it is. And so that's why athletes are much more, they go from compulsion to addiction because it's easier because they really are addicted to it.
Yeah, and that's another important thing. Do people know about endorphins? The biochemical bases in our body that attach to nerves and give you a sense of euphoria or no pain or just kind of feeling good. There's a lot of studies now that are saying taking drugs or like alcohol and so forth stimulates endorphin production, and that's what gives you the sense of euphoria or high. And you can pump those endorphins by exercise real easy. I can see it. I can go out and run for 5 miles and get an endorphin surge like crazy. I can go out and cross-country ski and get double the amount. Because I'm using my upper body and my lower body. So what would I rather do? Cross-country ski. It's a much better feeling. And it's mood altering. The thing I think that's important is let's talk about other addictive behaviors. What other ones can you think of?
Eating.
Eating. Give me some more ideas.
Okay. Working.
Okay. Work. Sleep.
Relationships.
Yeah.
Sex.
Okay. Sex.
Would you consider garage saving?
I had a client I was seeing in therapy once who was telling me at the end of the session, boy, I'm just so excited I'm going sailing this weekend. And I said, where are you going to go? I didn't even think, you know, you had a boat. She said, oh no, we're going to 6 garage sale Saturday. Well, what's the, okay, let's just do a little dissection of garage sales. What's the distraction? What's the excitement?
Getting something cheap.
Getting a deal? Getting something cheap? What else?
Just finding, not knowing what you'll find, I guess.
Yeah.
Finding the treasure.
Yeah. The treasure hunt? Or, yeah, haggling with somebody?
Feeling of accomplishment because you dude somebody down or got a better price. Or
yeah, the haggling, the bargaining, the competitive nature of, you know, the interaction.
Being there first.
Okay, right. Being the first one there. How about, you know, I've seen people come to garage sales at 4 in the afternoon when they started at 7 and they still get out of their car and run. What's that for? Just because they're just convinced there's something they're going to find there that's a wonderful treasure, and they want to make sure no one beats them to it. And when they get there to through your, you know, your eyes, there's no treasures there. But what happens? Well, they find one.
They make one.
They make one. You're right. It doesn't matter whether there is one there or not. They need to find one, and so they'll discover one. They'll create one. I think that shopping is a real obvious one. Spending is another real obvious one.
Saving?
Sure.
Gambling.
Yeah, gambling. Create expectations about it. I think there are also great distractions. Right? They're great ways to escape and avoid.
Reading.
Yeah.
Talking.
I have an addictive aunt. My aunt is addicted to talking on the telephone. Always talking on the phone. And a few times I got trapped when my mother wasn't home and she needed to talk. You know? What else?
Music playing all the time.
Yeah. Okay. Sound, music, noise.
Going to church.
Worship. Going to church?
Yes.
Making lists? Yeah. Writing on whiteboards? Come on, let's have more.
Chocolate.
I think sniffing these things.
Going to Holden?
Yeah.
Yeah? Anybody here been to Holden more than 6 times? You might be addicted. Now, the thing that I think is real important is it a distraction? Does it cause problems? You know, going anything, like somebody said, could be addicting. That doesn't mean that everything is addicting. What I think it means is that anything has the potential, depending on the relationship that you establish with that thing or person or activity or whatever it is. And is that relationship a running away, a distraction? Is it an avoidance from the real issues, from the feelings, from the things that need to be done? A real obvious addicting kind of behavior is procrastination. Procrastination is one of the best distractions there is. It is distraction, isn't it? It's the relationship, not the thing. Is it distracting? Does it draw you away from the feelings, the emotions, the work, or the tasks, or the relationships that need to be dealt with and worked on? And does it cause problems? And does it alter mood? Is it distracting enough to be reinforcing? Now the thing to pay attention to is distractions don't always have to make you feel good. All they need to do is change how you feel. There are a lot of people who won't allow themselves to feel good. It's not okay to be Lutheran and feel good. But if you can find something that you can develop a relationship with that'll distract you from feeling awful to just feeling less awful or bad, it's mood altering. It distracts you away, and it may be repetitive, it may be reinforcing, and you may become addicted to it if it eventually creates problems.
Yeah, I'm curious about what you mean by creating a problem. Like I'm thinking, say for example, you know, a husband who's addicted to watching sports on TV or something. Now with one wife, I mean, when I'm thinking in terms of problems, I'm thinking, you know, one husband like that, the wife may be very accepting, she goes and does her things, and, you know, they get along well, they're separated. Another, the guy with
a different, same guy with a different wife might have problems. She might be real frustrated with that. So is it addicting in one relationship and not another? Or, you know, how would you...
It could be. I think what you need to take a good, in-depth look at is... The guy lying on the couch, you know, 8-10 hours a day drinking beer, developing a coronary, losing touch with his children.
So the destructiveness doesn't necessarily mean your relationship with other people. In that sense, destructive, it could be what you're doing to yourself by avoiding physically or by avoiding other things you should.
The distraction. Does it, is it distracting him from working a job all week long that he absolutely detests? So he gives himself this little short mini vacation to rest up and go back to the sawmill that's just so miserable, but at least he has his binge next Sunday to look forward to help him through the week. When maybe what he needs to do is address the issue and the problem of what's going on at work and find some way to change or resolve that issue rather than stay in the misery because he, from Sunday to Sunday, can escape for a little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have a friend that was in her congregation for a while. She's an oncologist, deals with loads and loads of cancer patients. I'm just trying to put it all together in terms of what you're presenting. Said she has never had a person even on strong drugs, the morphine types, which normally are thought of as addicting, that could not just let it go when the pain need for it was gone. And so it was a distraction from the pain in a certain sense.
Yeah.
But it was not addicting. Didn't have the same meaning that it would have for somebody that you think of as a heavy drug addict. Mm-hmm. All of them in her practice could quit when it wasn't needed.
And that's the real difference between using a chemical to cope with pain or using a chemical to run away from reality and run off into euphoria or things. Coping with pain isn't any longer an issue when the pain is gone. And so the reason for using the chemical maybe no longer is needed. But using a chemical to get high and to party and to be part of a peer group and to escape stuff that when you're not using the chemical you come down to and is painful, that's the other element. That's the other part of using the chemical. And that's the euphoric, probably addictive nature about it. It again is a distraction. And for her, you know, coping with the pain was just, I suppose in a sense was a distraction, but when the pain was gone, her need for distraction was gone. Who's first? Let's try here and we'll go back there. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I was just thinking, some of these distractions are like rewards. I deserve a piece of chocolate cake because, or I deserve to nap because, or I deserve to nap because. And what I'm wondering about is not so much in adult world, but how we approach our children. We give them a reward if they do this or because they do this. We kind of set up our kids for this lifestyle.
Yeah.
The distraction being a reward.
Absolutely.
It's real scary. You can watch TV tonight. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's just the way we word things. Not that TV's bad, just the way we word it.
Yeah. Something in the Bible that says the behavior of the parents will be visited on the children.
I think
you teach it. It's something we've learned. It's something we teach by behavior, and we don't even know we're doing it. And the reward is reinforcing enough for us to learn it.
But isn't that what everybody does in a paycheck? Isn't that our reward? And so for a child, money doesn't mean anything. You do need to set up something that says, this is your reward.
But so it shouldn't be a reward. Food shouldn't be a reward.
No, 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 not food, but it could be other things, you know, what are you saying?
I think if we taught our kids that we only pay them when they work only to be paid, we need to teach them that sometimes they just work.
Well, yeah, I don't need monetary payment.
Well, neither do I. They can pay them when the TV show on, yeah, to the club.
Or our time.
Yeah.
Something special with mom.
I don't know if we've always taught them to just work or just to do that. We set up their life to be the Michigan kids.
Yeah, what's the alternative?
To teach them that part of life is working or sharing. That's just.
Read, maybe for the enjoyment of reading, not read, so that, you know, I figured I really need to have a reward for reading the book.
Or get a sticker or something. Not that I do those things.
No, but you should use rewards to alter their behavior. And that's as opposed to spanking them or maybe something more destructive.
Well, I think, let's not get off into rewarding positive behavior because it's, you know, it's a, I think, a valid motivating factor. The thing we have to look at is, do we do it to excess? Or is the consequence of doing it reinforcing their distractions? Or is it destructive? And again, anything can become a distraction, can become mood altering, can become destructive, but it doesn't have to be. It's the not doing it well, it's doing it to excess. Kathy?
How familiar are you with research about the
Well, there's a lot of stuff being done that way. I'm trying to determine about the genetic basis of inheriting chemical addictions. And there are scientists getting more and more bold about saying, yes, it's an inherited factor. And I've talked to a lot of alcoholics who have said, I knew before I ever even drank that I was going to be an alcoholic. I knew before I had my first beer, and I knew when I had my first beer that I liked it and wanted as much as I could get and more. So I think we're finding out more and more and more about that sort of stuff. The difficulty is that many chemically dependent people grow up in addictive families, and they learn the behavior by seeing it modeled by their parents. And everybody that comes in for chemical dependency treatment, I ask them, who in your family was the addict? I say, well, nobody. I said, well, was Dad possibly a workaholic? Oh, my dad worked 3 jobs his whole life. But he had to, you know, because there were 6 kids. And Mom, well, what was she like? Well, she was always cleaning and ironing and washing. Well, it sounds like everybody was distracted and everybody was an aholic somehow into something. It's no wonder you chose drugs. That's easier than working hard. And you learned it. You learned that running away, altering mood by distracting yourself somehow was reinforcing. It was rewarding. And it worked fine for a while until all of a sudden it became pathological. And then you were caught. And you were out of control. And then everything started to become a mess. And then the cops got you and now you're here and we're going to fix you. One over here.
Like, you know, somebody's dealing with a great problem in their life or a great grief or something, one distraction is very necessary, and it's just a matter of knowing when it's time to stop being distracted and face it or, you know, drawing a minus. If you distracted yourself forever, that would be a problem.
But sure.
Maybe temporary distraction is healthy and not pathological.
You need to combine all these sorts of things, and if your distraction begins to cause problems, I think we're maybe talking about addiction.
Talk about distraction in this, you know, addictive sense. Are you sort of talking about preoccupation? Like that's, you know, what your life focuses on?
That's a symptom.
Well, not always. I think there are people who selectively use their distractions at, you know, the most opportune times. when the heat's on, they're golfing. Or when things are problems, you know, they're doing this or that.
Would that be but considered addictive then? No, that's what I'm thinking.
If it causes problems.
Addictive, then I think of it more as a preoccupation. That's what, you know, your life is focused on.
Yeah, and I think that's a real common myth that people have, that an addictive person's whole life is centered around this thing. Everything they do is involved in that, and that's not true all the time. That's probably true for chronic, really chronic, chemically dependent people, that nothing else matters anymore, I just want my drink. But there are early and middle stage chemically dependent people, and there are early and middle stage addictive personalities that their life yet hasn't gotten so destructive that everything focuses on that. They still have an ability to be involved in other things and keep some balance, but there's other parts of their life that are distractive and cause destruction.
So what do you need to do? Just take a week out of your life and cut out all your distractions and see how you respond to that. Where do you kind of do checkpoints?
Where do you do checkpoints?
Yeah.
I think a real helpful thing is, that I often tell people to do is to look for the action. The little word is the action. The action is the distraction. Where it's happening is possibly what you're distracting yourself to. What do you like to do the most? What do you dream about doing? Or when you're someplace that you're just trying to tolerate a situation, what do you float off to? And can't wait till you get to do or dream about doing soon, that kind of stuff. To start identifying what some of your distractions are. Then start to take a look at, is it possible that sometimes those cause problems? And clearly you need to ask a whole bunch of people around you that know about these distractions to truthfully tell you about the problems, if there are any. Because one of the interesting things we're going to talk about tomorrow is that almost every addictive person is in a good, close, workable relationship with a codependent. And a codependent is an addictive personality type who gets distracted by an addict and runs away from their own feelings and their own identity and their own sense of worth and value by getting all caught up in this other person who's totally out of control and very addicted, and they're trying to always control and manage and keep in line that other person. And the real problem for the addicted person with a professional codependent at their side is got no concept of the consequences being destructive, because they're all covered up and they're picked up and they're taken care of. And then they ask their codependent, well, is it a problem that I'm doing? Oh, no, that's not a problem. And the little, you know, cooperative kind of relationship all of a sudden becomes totally distorted and in denial, and nobody knows the truth and nobody knows anybody else. And that's what we're going to talk about tomorrow, our codependence. The other side of the addict that takes two to tango, all that kind of stuff. And anybody who knows an alcoholic knows at least three or four codependents.
Dealing with kids, are there certain symptoms or things that they may do when they're young or whenever that we might need to watch out for, that they may be headed towards the road for addiction? Are there, you know, symptoms or signs to watch for when they're young?
I think the best preventive medicine for little kids is the parents. That the way we live and the way we model behavior and the way we interact with them and the extent to which we encourage them to find out who they are and affirm their own unique differences is real important. A clear destructive, addictive relationship for some people is being mom or dad. They're addicted to their kids. I know a family therapist who says the biggest operation that needs to be done in our nation is parentectomies. We can just get parents to cut off from their kids and let them become people instead of keeping them kids. And how many adult children aren't there of us walking around with parents who still, when we go home and we're in our 40s, try to tell us, oh, I shouldn't have done that, you know better. I mean, that clinging, hanging on, being distracted because, why? A parent needs to feel needed. And you get your needs met that way. I really believe the best medicine for children is parents getting their act together and knowing how to affirm and encourage and relate to and let go of their kids.
To
I give
feedback on it. To me, the most memorable single statement comes from a book somebody loaned me years ago on Gestalt Family Therapy. One thing that stuck with me of it was that when he was talking about bringing in the whole family, the kids and everybody for work, he said that when the parents are making progress with their problem, the children can be dismissed from therapy.
Yeah, I do a lot of family therapy with families of delinquent boys who are sentenced to a residential living situation, and it's amazing how these boys really are the first family therapists. That they had to go to the extent of running away from school consistently after being court ordered to not skip school and get sent up the river before they could get their parents into family therapy. And before they could, and they found that that was a really healthy way to get into trouble with the law in order to distract their parents from fighting so that they wouldn't get a divorce. They got in trouble with the law and distracted the arguments over and got to focus on the kid, and then they got sent up to this place where the parents had got to go for family therapy. And that's a really creative way to get mom and dad to stop fighting, not get divorced, and get into family therapy. And any family therapist, I think, that knows really what they're doing when they sit a family down and ask their family, now, okay, what are the problems here, is going to go to the youngest kid and say, tell me about your family. They're the ones that are going to tell you everything that's going on. No one else really knows. And then when mom and dad start working and some of the older kids start working, things start getting healthier. Little kids can go. Sometimes they don't need it anymore. Because then the parents will stay in. An interesting concept also that's a really, real important to mention in this whole thing is the whole idea of locus of control. It's a psychological kind of way of understanding at what point in your life are decisions made, and do emotions and basically the control center of your life happen. And it's divided up into external locus of control and internal locus of control. And addictive people tend to have been taught and learned that happiness in life has to come to me from the outside. They've got an external locus of control. That the only way I'm a worthwhile, valuable person is if other people like me. Is if I perform and do well and get a lot of accolades, or that I can see real obvious the progression and the results of my work. It's all external. And who I am as a person, who I am as a valuable being, is outside of them. And I think what's real important to teach children is, no, that's a myth. That having an internal locus of control is very, very important. That you inside yourself know who you are, can discover and search out who you are, know how you feel, have the skills and abilities to relate to people. Only you can decide that you're okay. Only you can make yourself happy. And my kids used to come to me and say, oh, Dad, I'm really bored. What am I going to do? And I'd say, no, it seems to me that's your problem. What have you thought of? I'm not in this world to entertain you. Now, I'll sit down with you and think about some options, but until you decide something, you know, I'll give you 10 things that I think sound like fun, but you're going to turn them all down until you find something you like. Boredom isn't the consequence of the outside world not meeting your needs. It's what you've decided to choose. And sometimes they've said, oh, I'm really bored today, and my reaction has been, what'd you decide to feel that way for? That's a miserable thing to do. Why didn't you decide to do something fun? somewhere here, yeah.
The basic goal of the fact that someone doesn't know who they are is because they haven't been able to identify who they are. And they have parents who are giving this kind of feedback to them. How are we supposed to know who we are?
Well, I think one of the key things is that you come to Holden to a lecture where they tell you that if you've been looking outside of you and asking the outside world and the external places to tell you, you know, you're running down a blind alley that has no end.
But again, as we have so many things in our lives, we do not look at that. We aren't able to identify that.
And it's what you learn. You learn that that is the place to look. And I think that's a real obvious addictive kind of behavior, is that so much of our world is filled up with human doings, not human beings. That we're so busy doing to achieve worth and value that we have no sense of who we are as a being. Kathy first and then Doris. Flukes that happen in therapy, yeah. I've had clients that I was seeing 15 years ago, and they come up to me and said, you know, in that session where we did such and such, and you said da 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 da, I never forgot that, and it really made a difference to me. And I go, I said that? I don't remember saying that. And they say, oh yeah, you said this. And there have been a few cases where I know I didn't say that, but that's what they heard. And if it made a difference, I don't know. Doris?
Well, I think a lot of times parents give affirmation to children for the wrong things. that is, they affirm children only because they excel in some kind of an act or a skill. And instead of affirming them when they see them do something fine, or let them know that they are valued for themselves and not for what they do. But we're so quick to compare our children with somebody else or with their brothers and sisters, and we know that our gifts are all different.
And is achieving and competitiveness an addictive behavior?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think what's real important is loving your children for just who they are, not for what they do. You don't work. You're not work. And all the unemployed people, I've got a distraction, but I'm not a big distraction. Lots of unemployed people have tremendous struggles with self-esteem because they're not producing. Well, that's, again, external locus. It's been. And I think the things you touch on, unconditional love and unconditional forgiveness, I think are clear Christian concepts that Christ talks about a lot. And I think they're real important in relationships that are meaningful to you. It's the conditionality. If you do this, then I'll love you. If you do this, I'll forgive you. It's real and, you know, destructive and problematic.
One more thing. Brainwashing makes it hard to hear the gospel.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I was just going to say, having identified the problem, someone has identified the problem, what steps can they take? How do they shift to love and control? I mean, it's easier said than done, I assume. And good reason why they have an extra love and control. What good reasons or what do they do to change it?
Well, I think this is one of the reasons that there are a whole lot of self-help groups springing up. You know, there's Overeaters Anonymous, and there's Narcotics Anonymous, and there's Fundamentalists Anonymous. And I think those kind of self-help support groups are real important. And a lot of them base their whole approach on the 12 steps of AA. And the first step of AA talks about that you're willing to admit that you're powerless, that your life's unmanageable, that it's out of control. Once you're willing to admit that, at least, then you've got a place to start. But I think those kinds of self-help groups and those kinds of close relationships with other people that can help you work on that. I'd also say I think getting involved in some individual or counseling therapy, group therapy of some sort, with somebody that understands that stuff can be real helpful. But it isn't easy. What you're talking about is reprogramming and rechanging years of deeply ingrained behavior that you one of the important things I think in accepting the fact you're powerless and unmanageable about it is also accepting the fact that you're going to die with it. Probably never going to change it. But maybe between now and when you die, you can make some alterations that can minimize the destructiveness. But when the heat's really on, you're going to go back to it. Let's face it. We all binge. All of us addicts, you know, fall off the wagon. But we also need to learn that it's not awful and terrible and the end of the world and unforgivable when that happens. But that you can pick yourself up and get back on your recovery program and start doing some healthy things again.